Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
I've been looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for being with us today, Mark.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
All right, just to get us started, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up in the gaming industry.
Sure. During grad school, I was pondering the thought of going to law school, and I needed to earn money. And a friend of mine had gone to work for the regulatory agency that governs the gaming industry in Nevada. And at that time, there were a lot of public companies that had entered the gaming industry space, and they needed desperately to hire financial people. And I was a financial graduate. I have an undergraduate degree in finance. And so I was lucky enough to be hired on by the regulatory agency as an investigative agent, not thinking that it would become a career. I intended to do it for a year or two and then be off to law school. And frankly, the bug got to me. I grew up in Nevada, so I was very familiar with the industry, but had never considered it as a career. But once I learned a lot about public companies, it was a space that I became very intrigued with. And my thesis advisor in grad school was the foremost expert on the study of commercial gaming, a guy that I consider to this day a mentor, even though he passed away. He was a coach for me throughout my career. His name was Dr. Bill Edington, and he looked at the industry, you know, from an academic perspective. And he and I shared a lot of conversations about, you know, how the industry will probably change and mature. And so we were together for probably 20 years watching that all occur. So the gaming industry kind of found me, and I kind of found it. After spending a few years as a regulator and doing investigations at public companies, I jumped to a small startup company called Casino Data Systems and was fortunate to have a great mentor that was the chairman and founder of that company that really gave me a boost to my career. I had set out to be an executive officer before I was 30, and he was very helpful in helping me get there. I probably didn't deserve it, frankly. But he was a great coach. And so the rest is kind of history from that point forward. I worked in the industry and ever since. And we can get into other elements of my career later if you'd like. But that's essentially how I found my way into the gaming industry.
Wonderful. Thanks for that summary. That's really great. Online gaming has seen a tremendous growth within the past decade as people have favored playing online versus visiting a brick and mortar establishment. What impact has this shift had on the customer experience, and what are some of the risks that have come with it from your perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's very topical. I don't think you can pick up a newspaper or read online today the interest that people have in sports betting, which has really, I think, cracked the egg on national online gaming. Several states have now adopted at least that as a form of online gaming. And it really starts to put into motion a series of core questions. You know, our industry is likely the most regulated industry in the country. And a lot of the whole policy framework around commercial gaming circles around the limitations that are present in the originating legislation. So when states decide to legalize gaming, whether it's riverboats or limited stakes or just a limited number of licenses, it's typically done so around a tight regulatory rubric. And when people ponder the trade-offs now with allowing online gaming, there's some real policy questions that need to be addressed. Second in that is also the material business that Native American tribes have across the country, where they've entered into essentially contracts with states that limit what states are able to do in terms of commercial gaming. So we're right in the early stages of having to you know, gnash through all those complexities. And I would say on the plus side, as an industry, a lot of the historical framework of inviting and attracting people to integrated resorts, whether it's a riverboat regionally or whether it's Las Vegas, is all around the come and visit, you know, and have the physical experience. And that can be, you know, now fantastic food and beverage offerings and nightclub scenes and entertainment and concerts at the very highest level. And that obviously doesn't translate to the online experience directly. But what I would say from our industry perspective, while we've been focused on that small segment of the population that enjoys making that trip to that regional casino for that real world experience, there is a vast number of customers that are probably attracted to the gaming experience, but have no desire to go to, you know, a casino itself for whatever reason. You know, they want to consume the product, but they don't want to be present in a brick and mortar facility. So I think it's going to open up a very large marketplace for the gaming industry. And that's becoming pretty apparent when you look at the kind of hyper growth that's occurring right now. There's pent up demand for legal sports wagering, and that's manifesting itself. I think we all know pretty well that most people were probably engaged in sports wagering before, likely right, with their bookies and their offshore offerings. So now that it's legal in a lot of states, I think we're going to see that that's going to be a marketplace that we can tap into that broadens the audience. But we will struggle with people that have invested billions of dollars in their brick and mortar facilities, whether it's a Native American tribe or whether it's people on the Las Vegas Strip. There has to be a consideration for the impact of that decision one way or the other. So it's a complex challenge for the industry, but it's one that I think generally points north, which is much higher growth.
You've talked about how legal wagering has been expanded to a lot of states in recent years. And from a technology standpoint, how has the gaming industry changed within the last 5 years? And what do you predict will happen within the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's always been present for those people who kind of conjure up the idea of what it means to gamble. There is a lot of allure to, you know, the old school sit at a felt table and feel the cards and feel the dice and experience a slot machine, you know, for the thrill of that, you know, what that lights and sounds and artistic capabilities of all of our developers that do such a great job. And there's incremental changes that makes that experience easier. Things like bill validators were a major change in our industry to allow people to avoid having to place coins in a machine, to now the advent of integrated cashless wallets that allow people to move their money around. And it's changed the way machines are experienced. It gives the customer essentially a menu of choices when they sit down at a game. They might be able to play different denominations so they can risk differing amounts of money. They might shop for different kinds of play experiences. People pursuing big awards versus smaller pays on slot machines. The introduction of mobile just enhances that greatly. So I think, you know, technology in our industry generally lags, which is in one way unfortunate, as we've watched the other kind of gamification that occurs online and in apps. Our industry goes through substantial testing and validation of the products. There's this inherent trust relationship with a gambling customer in a casino. And I think our industry, rightfully so, pays great attention to that. No one in our industry wants there to be a sense that someone's not getting a fair shake. I don't think we're shy about saying that the house has the advantage. There's no doubt about that. Right. We wouldn't have the buildings we have and the technology we have if it was otherwise. But that trust relationship, when someone, you know, jumps into a blackjack table or plays a slot machine, that they are getting a fair shake and that machine is not cheating the player. Because of that, we have these really strict regulatory requirements and testing requirements. The trade-off there is that creates a lot of expense and a lot of energy, and actually suppresses the innovation cycle. So I think that's one of our challenges as an industry is, you know, watching how game companies have built trust without that regulatory structure, knowing that reputation is on the line. So if someone was offering a game in the online world or in the app world, if they were to found to have cheated their customers, I think customers vote with their feet, you know, very effectively. So there's probably some opportunity on the technology side of our industry to start considering the impact of reputation and maybe putting more trust in the developers themselves in a way that will help speed the innovation cycle. Because today we are, you know, we do have that challenge that our innovation cycle just isn't nearly where it should be.
I want to follow up on something you mentioned earlier with regards to how we know people have been engaging in sports betting, let's say with their offshore bookies. And for some reason, the US has been behind on adopting this. I know for a fact in the UK, sports betting is part of their society. And we're seeing more and more states, you know, being more open to sports betting. From a regulatory perspective, why do you think there's been that delayed push for the adoption of legalized sports betting in America?
I'm certain that the catalyst was a reconsideration of the Wire Act and its impact on how gaming is limited in the U.S. So frankly, from the perspective of how did the policy change, it was literally a decision by our Supreme Court that put put it in play. I think secondarily, I was a part of the Nevada effort here when I was chairman of the regulatory body to adopt the first set of online gaming regs with an eye towards, you know, where is innovation going? More and more things are going online. So we took the effort to write the first set of gaming regs that would allow it. And when we did that, I think it gave other jurisdictions, most notably New Jersey, some confidence to adopt regulations that would allow for, you know, online gaming in their state. And I think they've done a wonderful job in jumping right in. And so the enabling kind of regulatory infrastructure is I think the spark that got it going. And then when the Supreme Court ruled recently that the Wire Act changes were such that it allowed for states to adopt their own financial or their own regulatory structures within their four walls, it gave states the legalization opportunity to do it so that it wasn't a violation of federal law any longer. And I think there's also another kind of underlying piece to it that commercial gaming, if you talk to people in the 70s, still had a kind of cloud associated with it. There was still a lot of people that had gone through the late 60s organized crime hearings in Congress. And so there still was a tinge about the gaming industry and what it meant. So I think we needed to go through that. Like it or not, it took 20 years to go through that kind of societal acceptance of commercial gaming. And so, you know, now you see generally gaming is well accepted entertainment opportunities, you know, across the board. Within, you know, usually if you look at the states now, you will find that there's a regional casino, riverboat, Native American tribal casino within driving distance of almost anybody in the country, and people have been warm to accept it. So I think the combination of it becoming, you know, a just legitimate form of entertainment and the changes to the regulatory structure finally got us over the hump and probably made people comfortable that, you know, look, these people are already doing it. If we have a law that says it's not okay to do that, people are still going to do it because they have a regular access to their offshore bookies, and it became partly a means to generate some financial returns for state coffers as well.
Lots of organizations struggle with strategy execution, especially when it was poorly articulated and not properly implemented. What recommendations would you make to other leaders and companies that may be facing such a scenario given the consequences of COVID-19 pandemic? Do you have any relatable examples that you can share?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I probably would have thought one way earlier in my career, you know, learning from, you know, the textbooks and participating, you know, with professors in organizational development and finance. And I think I've evolved that, you know, having worked with a number of CEOs and participated with board members. I think it's clear you have to have, you know, an agenda, you have to have a strategy, and it has to be well articulated. And I think that has to be well communicated to everyone in the organization. But I would also say that the past ideas about rigidity of think, you know, single-mindedness is probably likely in today's world likely to lead to less success than more success. I think any business plan today has to have change and flexibility built in. My experiences are that businesses are moving so fast and the pace of change is so readily apparent that any strategy that you come up with has to have change built into it. And I think that mindset has to be part of the culture of your organization. So you might have a target and you might have a true north about where you're going and what your strategy is. I would just caution people that if you don't have a change mechanism built into your strategy, that you likely will see others overcome, you know, your business plans, because you just can't constantly stay on a singular path. I think there is a true north, but I think you have to have change built into your plans. COVID's a great example of that, right?
Yeah, right. You're true. Competition has become very stiff during these hard times for many organizations that have had to downsize because of the pandemic this year. To the extent that you can share with us, what strategies have you employed in the past that consistently help you come up with innovative ways to maximize existing resources in order to gain or strengthen your organization's competitive advantage?
Sure, that's an interesting question. I guess the first thing that springs to mind is, you know, a constant vigilance around your cost structure and where you're investing your dollars. If it's people, oftentimes those are a significant portion of the cost structure of any business. It's a diligence around where do you have your dollars invested and what's coming from that distribution of employees. So, you know, measuring, for example, you know, total cost of employment around a product line and looking at trends around those product lines. Are they growing? Are they shrinking? And making sure that you have alignment with your customers or your clients. I think those are critical components of, you know, you can find yourself, if you don't pay attention to those things, having an overinvestment in a shrinking business and having a competitor that is not laden with that burden, so that it makes the shift to trying to catch that new entrant more difficult. So I think using traditional KPIs around where you have people and if there are appropriate returns on the amount of money you're spending, you know, if you recognize it early enough in the cycle, you may find yourself, you know, introducing new products or shifting into those new products quicker or asking your customers to make those shifts sooner in the evolution cycle. You know, it could save you from having much more difficult times down the road. So those are kind of tools that I think are pretty tried and true, but they're really relevant. You know, asking that question, if I'm investing, you know, six figures in an employee, is that employee generating, you know, an appropriate return on that investment? It seems simple, but in the aggregate, I think those are key. And you can apply that to other cost structures in the business as well.
I have a follow-up question on that. So at the beginning of the year, at least here in the States, there was a lot of companies that were performing well financially, and they may have invested in different technologies, in different ideas that are, you know, costly, but they had projected ROIs that will come up with, let's say, within the next 2, 3, 5 years. And now that we're faced with the COVID pandemic, a lot of things have happened where many companies are facing diminishing returns to those investments. At what point, from a leadership perspective, do you decide to abandon those initiatives in the face of saving up on costs?
It's tough to answer that in the context of COVID, because some of those things are fairly cut and dry. You know, you have the potential luxury of reinvesting dollars, you know, into future products. And if you're in a significant cash crunch, like many businesses found themselves in COVID, you know, it's a simple thing to say, you know, we just have to shelve those for now, because we're literally talking about survival. So, you know, the luxury of investing in products that have a horizon more than 2 years out, you know, for me, that's not a difficult decision. You have to first survive and move on. In the general sense, you know, absent COVID, I think you do have to consider, when you're spending money on new initiatives, what the likelihood of success is and the time frame associated with it. I've been involved in several projects that, you know, we invested a fair amount of money in and looked at the marketplace as being exciting, but, you know, after being in it a year or two, finding that the product we were creating was too complex for our patrons and our customer database, and having to make the decision to cut early because we didn't see those conditions changing. So I think recognizing, you know, customer acceptance in within the cycle of development is pretty critical. You can spend bad money forcing yourself, and if you're really excited about an idea and you've invested a lot of energy in it, it can be a real challenge for the employees to let something go that they've spent a lot of time on. But I think that's good discipline to figure out that, you know, we had this great idea, we invested money in it, but it's just not going to develop the returns that we hoped for. And being honest with the team that, you know, that a certain amount of money has to be spent on innovation for sure. But also recognizing that you want to have products that are exciting and that generate the returns.
Here at Process IT, I deal a lot with all types of hiring managers from C-level to the lower levels. I'm curious to know from your perspective, when faced with two equally qualified candidates, how do you determine whom to hire? What are some of the things that you look for that won't jump out from a resume that you've seen help leaders like yourself make the best hiring decisions?
Yeah, that I think a lot depends on the circumstances of the hire. I would encourage my managers, if you had people with, let's assume that your proposition is accurate, that two people have the same technical qualifications, you could have a circumstance where you're looking to invite new disruptive influences into the company to spark new energy on a team. So you may opt for the individual that has a more outgoing and disruptive personality that is willing to challenge the status quo. And the opposite might be true in circumstances where you have a highly functional team and you don't want that disruption. So it could very well be that you have two technically qualified people, but they have different personality traits. And so I think that would drive, you know, which of the complementary skill set are you trying to introduce into the group? I'm not a big fan of kind of a uniform set of hires. I think there are, having done a lot of development work with executives, you know, there are introverts and extroverts in any organization and different personality traits, and they all pay dividends. You can't just hire all outgoing people and you can't just hire all introverts. I think culturally that probably doesn't give you the best outcome. So I think a lot of it, on the individual basis to your question, results in what you're trying to achieve, you know, with that next hire, presuming that they're all equally qualified. I would say, though, that a couple traits that I always look for, once you get past the technical competence of any, you know, person that applies, is the, you know, the passion and the commitment that people have, and the integrity, and making sure that when you're evaluating them and their history, even things that go back to, you know, high school, college, and maybe 10 years before in their career, you know, things they've done that can address those kinds of questions. Like, you know, what have you done in your career when you've been faced with an integrity issue, or what have you done to overcome a challenge? And that could be manifested in whether they you know, achieved a certain rank in a band or a Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts or a sporting event or, you know, whatever those things that you can uncover in their background that helps you understand whether they're up for, you know, the commitment where they have a demonstrated, you know, path towards commitment versus another candidate who doesn't have those kinds of skills. I think those can be big differences in output when you ultimately hire those people onto a team.
There's certain leaders that I've spoken with in the past that prefer, there's a leader that I spoke with that preferred people that were previously in sports, they were athletes, because it brings out a competitive nature when they join the team. And there's also on the flip side, people like, let's say, Elon Musk, who prefer people that have that mechanical experience, the people that like to build things, that go and take things apart and understand how things were put together. Is that something that a leader can push from the top so that all the hiring managers below all the way to the lower levels can adopt that kind of mindset?
I think those are both relevant. I would never say that I think there's a lot of analogy. I'm a sports person, so I can get comfortable with the idea of sports, but I think you have to go past just someone who's participated in sports. Uh-huh. I think you have to understand what they did. You know, were they someone that overcame an injury? Were they someone that was the captain of the team that had leadership skills? Were they someone that, you know, perhaps wasn't a starter? You know, they were struggling and, you know, they weren't the star of the show, but played an important role. And viewed it as a serious achievement that, you know, perhaps they did a lot to even make the team in the first place. I think you have to go past just participating in sports and understand why is that relevant. I think there's a lot of analogy in sport and business where competition is keen and there is a sense of team and, uh-huh. you know, that's critically important. Your other point about in today's world, I often look for and have interviewed people at very high levels. And I find that people that have worked their way up through an organization who have maybe the Elon Musk thought process of, you know, they've had their hands dirty, you know, they have been able to, you know, see the organization from different perspectives, rather than someone who perhaps joined a super large organization from the beginning and has always been surrounded by a support team. And you put them in a leadership role, and maybe it's a small organization. This would be true of a startup, for example. If they don't have all that support system around them, I think you could put them in a position where they may fail because they're not aware of, you know, what they need to succeed. In other cases, if it is a large organization, then obviously that skill set applies. So I think you have to dig kind of one or two levels deeper, depending on the size of the organization and the role that you're putting that person in.
Looking at your transition from politics back to corporate, based on that experience, please share with us any practical recommendations on how to succeed through such a transition. What were some of the lessons learned, and what do you wish you knew ahead of time?
Yeah, the very brief time that I spent as a senator here in Nevada was a good one. I by no means would I suggest that I have the kind of experience that some of my colleagues had in the legislature. But what I would say that politics reveals when you're on the inside of the machine that I probably didn't have a great sense of is that there are slivers of time that legislative leaders, and probably this applies at the congressional level times 10, there are very small amounts of time that these political leaders get to make decisions that could have meaningful ramifications on a business or an organization. And to appreciate that, having been on the inside of it, when you're essentially on the floor of the Senate and having to place a vote on something that perhaps you've been informed, you know, maybe you've spent 5 or 10 minutes being informed by either a colleague in the Senate or an effective lobbyist, that, you know, you're affecting people's lives. And some of them are easy. You know, some of the public policy votes that come your way are simple and they make sense and it's right for society and right for business or right for an organization. But during my tenure, we had the Uber vote, the Uber and Lyft vote come before us. And in Nevada, you know, there was a very established taxi cab business that had, you know, invested in our community for decades. And these are people that are, you know, integrated into the community. And now there's this new technology that, if allowed, would fundamentally change transportation, you know, for the state. And those are harder calls. And it involves, you know, having to be mindful of the ramifications. So I would say that, you know, the impact of having been on the inside of the machine sensitizes me to A, the importance of lobbyists. I think they kind of get a bad rap for the most part, but they are typically people that are there, you know, as advocates for their organizations. And I don't nearly view them in the negative light that I might have before. I think they play a very important role in educating people. They're typically the vessels that contain a lot of information because they've been in those roles for those clients, sometimes for decades. So they know the nuance. And I think they, you know, understanding and having an appreciation for that when a piece of public policy comes before a body, it can have material ramifications. And you see people on Twitter, you know, that are very quick to summarize, you know, circumstances, and often there's a lot more nuance to it, and it's easy to take a side. But when you really evaluate the impact of either, you know, a health policy or a transportation policy or a, you know, social impact, it's pretty heady stuff, and it's certainly something I have a greater appreciation for.
Last question, and this is one question that is one of my favorites because I get to ask everybody the same question and get different responses based on different experiences that everybody went through. What has helped you get to where you are, and what word of advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's similar to yours?
Wow, that gets to kind of fundamentals. I think early on, I had the benefit of being surrounded by people that had good integrity and good ethics. And I'm not sure that comes forward a lot in undergraduate programs, people that, you know, want to get into higher management. And I think there's a bit of it that comes through, but I think that notion of doing the right thing, you know, kind of consistently, being truthful and being honest and being committed. There's a lot of people that have great talent, but just don't have the level of commitment. I think no matter what role you take on, you know, proving that you are committed to the cause and that you have a passion for it, that I guess that would be the one other thing that jumps off the page, is find opportunities that you feel passionate about. You know, I'm involved in, you know, still technology companies, and have hired some people recently. And one of the individuals came from out of state, and his just number one desire was to be involved in the technology space around sports. And you could just see it, you know, oozing out of him. And he was willing to do almost anything to get his foot in the door because it was something that, you know, is just his number one. And I think finding that passion, it sounds trite, you know, it sounds, you know, every graduation speech you've ever heard, you know, probably has some form of that message, but it bears a lot of truth that, you know, time is short and you should find things that you enjoy and probably avoid the things that you don't have passion for. Because I've discovered that, you know, over the past 25 years that, you know, time spins faster and faster, and you should really find the things that you enjoy, because you'll probably be better at what you do. And then stay true to ethics and integrity and honesty. And you will be found out if you try to take shortcuts. That shortcut path, you know, very rarely pays off.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today, Mark. It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, Fred, thank you. Happy to do it.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.